You're listening to a journalism.co.uk podcast.
I'm Andy Frost, Chief Constable, British Transport Police. A while ago, I think it was in December, a few years ago, a journalist was going on about how dangerous certain tube stations were in London around violence until he pointed out they'd picked on, you know, Russell Square, Edgware Road and Aldgate. Of course, these were the ones that featured in the 7/7 bombing. And the crime stats for that year were obviously inflated by that incident.
I'm James Ball. I am a data reporter at The Guardian, and using numbers is a huge part of my job. It's impressive how often journalists will freely admit that they don't like numbers and find it quite difficult to use, because a huge amount of our job is actually trying to make them understandable. And the ways we get that wrong sometimes are often quite fun. Last week there was a story about the Metropolitan Police spending £35,000 on calls to the speaking clock, which sounds absolutely ridiculous. You get a picture of police officers everywhere respectively burning money. But it's a good example of a hazard for reporters like us, because it's a really tempting story. But the Metropolitan Police has about 36,000 police officers and 1,000 more support officers. And it's kind of important to be able to tell the time now and then when you're a police officer. You might need to synchronise your watches or your mobiles. You might be taking a statement, and the time you're doing it is important. If you're logging an arrest of someone that was running away from something, maybe 3 minutes would make a big difference. And I've also learned since the speaking clock's used if the time on CCTV monitors disagrees. Now, about 16k a year for that turns out to be about 50,000 calls, because they're about 30 pence each. And so this story about police wasting loads of money actually turned out to be each police officer calling the speaking clock once or twice a year. So a figure that looks ridiculous can actually represent something perfectly sensible.
I remember a few years ago, a local paper in Outer London that named a very minor railway station as the, you know, the most dangerous one we had, and which was quite shocking. It was sort of a leafy suburb. And then we found out that, you know, the local guy who runs the station reported every single type of scratch or mark as criminal damage, and we reported it. But it was outflanking some of our major London stations, and all that took was a little bit of research to point out that, you know, this place isn't dangerous.
There's a huge amount of talk at the minute about saving public money and public sector waste and how we can cut the deficit. And if we give the impression, rightly or wrongly, that money's wasted, we should be trying to make sure it's at least fair and it's in context. Now, other examples where numbers can be shaky was when the Telegraph on a front page, and this was quite some time ago, was trying to report that public sector pensions in 10 years' time, if nothing was reformed, would cost us £400 each a year. Unfortunately, someone doing the reporting missed a number and said £4,000 a year.
Oh, yeah.
And their headline said, "We pay that now." Now, obviously people make mistakes with their maths. I mean, I do it quite regularly. But the problem with this was that £4,000 a year is actually more than most of us pay in income tax. So that's suggesting that the whole money the public sector gets is essentially blown on pensions, which makes no sense. What we have to learn to do, and the best way to save ourselves from getting embarrassed, is essentially to kind of stop and check something makes sense. You know, there's nothing wrong with that moment of going, okay, this looks like a brilliant story. Is this number real? And that can save us quite a lot of blushes, really.
My name is Michael Blastand. I wrote a book called The Tiger That It Isn't, which is a guide to understanding numbers in the news. And I started a Radio 4 programme called More or Less, which does pretty much the same sort of thing.
He has some advice for journalists. This example relates to health and how to accurately report hospital waiting times.
It's very easy to be selective about the kind of waiting time or waiting list data that you use. And it's, some of these measures are more reliable than others. Some of them give a better account of how long people have actually waited when their wait has finished. And it's also quite important to get a sense of what the typical wait is like, rather than, say, the average wait. Now, some people say, well, the average is the same as typical. It's not. And I can illustrate that easily by saying that almost everybody has more than the average number of human feet. And you think, well, how can that be? Well, just think about it for a moment. You know, it takes a few people to have less than the average number of feet, and the average is pulled below 2. So almost everybody can have more than the average. In the same way, almost everybody can wait longer than average or shorter than average. And this can be distorted by the effect of a few numbers, the experience of a few people. So the best thing to do is take the median of completed waits. That data does exist, but be very careful with it. Make sure that that's the one you're looking at. I mean, there are other measures, and some of them have their advocates. That's the one I prefer. So how are we measuring the waiting when we say that waiting is getting longer or getting shorter?
Michael Blassan has some tips in how to approach stories that involve numbers. These are based on common errors he sees journalists making.
I think the simplest error is just to fail to ask yourself whether the number you're looking at really tells you what you think it tells you. And the most basic of these is to look at a number with a load of zeros on the end and assume that it's a big number, for example. And you can simply ask yourself, is that a big number? And that prompt is usually enough to start thinking about the kind of context that would tell you whether it's large relative to the population or the problem that you're discussing. Because big numbers are only big if you understand the context, for example. Another one is to look at runs of data, sudden changes in the data, some recent change, often linked to a political intervention or something like that, and say, my goodness, the world's changing, isn't it remarkable? And not to look at the longer run of data, which might tell you that these kind of changes up or down are pretty common every couple of years, 2 or 3 years, whatever, or that this one is actually going long-term in the opposite direction to the direction of the recent short-term change. And so there's no good reason for thinking that this is a profound change on what we've been used to, for example. Another one is to fail to inquire about whether the comparisons between, say, two countries or two groups of people are really as the way that they seem, because maybe those groups are different. Invariably, they are different. You know, if you're comparing universities in the United Kingdom with universities in the United States, then one of the salient factors is that the United States is 6 times bigger than the United Kingdom, that it spends twice as much of its national income on tertiary education as the UK universities. For example, there are endless things that go on in the background, and failing even to inquire about what sort of things those might be isn't really going to get you very far. Another one is to take changes in risk. A 20% increase in risk, 100% increase in risk can be a change from 1 in a million to 2 in a million. And I still don't care about that risk. But if you portray it as a 100% change, then you can frighten lots of people very easily. So they're all basic failures to inquire into the context that would help us understand what we're really being told by this number. And there's another one I'd add, a simple methodological one, which is, how did we get this data in the first place? There are very easy ways of coming up with rubbish if you ask the right people the right selective questions. And you need to be aware of how data is gathered. Always be aware that it's people generally who are collecting that data, and they're often collecting it from other people. And those people might be in particular groups, the samples might be biased, and so on.
Another instance when a journalist will need to get a grasp of numbers is in financial reporting, whether that's looking at a company report, government stats, or the annual budget.
I'm Professor Steve Schiffer, course director on the new MA in Financial Journalism at City University. And before that, I was an economics correspondent for BBC News Online. Well, I think there's three big issues that come up when we try to teach numeracy to financial journalism. First of all, there's just the idea of getting a better sense of the scale of numbers, particularly in financial journalism and the current crises we have. People need to really understand the difference between, you know, what would be the size of the national debt, say, in billions or trillions, what would be the size of company profits, what would be the size of debts and deficits. And it's something that unless journalists or financialists get this instinctively, they're going to easily make mistakes. And the second problem people have is in relationships of understanding particularly trends. I'm trying to get people to understand, you know, what growth rates are, what inflation rates are, how you measure things and what different measures are. I think the third thing is really trends and statistics. What is a trend? It's too easy. This is particularly something that companies do. It's saying what a change in figures from one year to another represents a trend. And it's also true in some economic figures that you really have to look over a period of time and you have to be very careful. Obviously, there's a news line often when a number jumps, but you do have to be quite careful in understanding what's the underlying trend and what's, in a sense, a random fluctuation.
I think the trick to getting numbers right is, firstly, just to stop and try and engage your common sense brain and almost go, really? You know, just as if quite a good source of yours have told you something that seems to be a bit unbelievable. So just to stop and go, does this make sense? If always try and be careful with things like percentage changes because they're often a bit tricksy. If something triples, it's actually only gone up by 200%, not 300%. The other thing to be very careful of is mixing up when two things go up together and when one's causing the other. This is called correlation. So the number of mobile phone masts and the fertility rate are really closely linked. The more mobile phone masts you have in any given area, the more babies you have. So does that mean that mobile phone masts improve fertility or that babies cause mobile phone masts to be built? Neither. Obviously, what happens is the more people live in an area, the more mobile phone masts it needs. The more people live in an area, the higher the fertility rate is generally. The more babies are born there. So there's often things that look like they might be linked, often aren't.
Chief Constable Andy Trotter has a message for journalists.
My sort of appeal to people who report on these things is to take some time to look at what they're saying, take some time to study the issues, and if necessary, talk to someone.
I think the other thing is to try and make it less acceptable as a reporter to say, I don't get numbers, I don't do numbers. We would never regard it as okay for a reporter to laugh and go, I never take notes, or to laugh and say, I'm always leaving details in my off-the-record sources around the office. And we have to, I think, move to making it a bit less okay to be bad at numbers. We don't all have to turn into maths professors. That would be awful. But we need to get the things that are a bit more complicated so we can make them understandable and clear to our audience, whether we work on a tabloid or a broadsheet or The Economist.
Andy Trotter again.
And I think there is this impatience with people sort of claiming not to understand stats. Well, I do think, you know, if ever I talk to trainee journalists, I think it should be a compulsory part of their education because people mislead all the time with numbers or mislead themselves with numbers. So I think a healthy scepticism, a healthy doubt and an inquiring mind and some modicum of technical ability is a basic requirement.
If you believe in data, then you must believe that data has something far better to offer than lies and damned lies of caricature or the sort of killer facts of swivel-eyed headlines. Data can give us profound knowledge if it's used carefully, and we need to be neither cynical nor naive, but alert. So these questions and these problems that I'm describing can often be the way to a better understanding and a better story. You know, I really insist on this. They're not just a way of knocking down the kind of hasty assumptions that people do all too often make. They are also a way of finding a better story.
That final word from Michael Blasland there. And for more on understanding numbers for news, go to journalism.co.uk. You've been listening to a journalism.co.uk podcast.